You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 392, Revelation 19, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you feeling?
Well, the first chemo cycle was a challenge, to say the least. I would use words like devastating, and I'm not trying to be dramatic. It's just, it's horrific. I've begun to refer to it basically as a tour of duty in hell. You know, so the next train to hell leaves this coming Wednesday, and I will be on it.
Yeah,
it's just unbelievable what it does to you. It hit me. The nausea is the issue. It's unrelenting, moment by moment, severe, like a 10 nausea, which of course means that you can't eat. I mean, if you did eat something, you'd probably barf it up. But in my case, you know, the cycle means when I go in, I'm not going to be eating anything for 3 or 4 days. So there's the weight loss issue. And then you gradually emerge from the abyss. Things sort of stabilize. It never completely goes away, but it's manageable if it's a 2 or 3. But if it's, you know, if it's just the high level stuff, it's just devastating. The people who this is their life, you know, like, you know, they just have to keep doing chemo, you know, to keep their cancer in check, and they don't really have a path to a cure. You know, in my case, we're this is all prep for surgery, but for the, you know, those who don't have that, I just don't know how they do it. You know, I understand, you know, that people just quit. You know, they lose the will to live. I mean, because, you know, who wants to do that? So the people who endure that, they are just heroic. I don't know any other way to describe it now, you know, that I've actually experienced, you know, just one cycle. I mean, I know people who are like pushing 20 cycles, and, you know, they'll tell you that it gets a little better, you know, as time goes on, your body adapts to it. But my body did not know what hit it.
Yeah.
So I'm one of these people, like, until this year, I had to be talked into taking ibuprofen. I don't take meds. I don't drink anything. I never have. You know, never did drugs, you know, in high school, you know, and it's like, I literally just did not know what hit me.
Yeah.
It was just unbelievable.
Yeah. Sounds like not fun. Well, we're glad.
No.
You, I don't know. Is it
the, I was going to say, I told my pastor, so on my next trip to hell, I'm going to wave to the watchers and tell them they still suck. But, you know, I'm going to have to visit them every 2 weeks, but
yeah.
You know, I'm out of here. You guys are stuck. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure it's hard. We appreciate you preparing for the podcast and doing the little work that you're able to do during those bouts. I'm sure it takes your mind off of it.
Energy level is pretty much nil those 4 or 5 days when it's slamming you. But, you know, you emerge out of it, and you get busy, you do things you can do, and that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, were you able to, at least on Sunday, I know you're sick, or be able to watch some football at least, or
baseball? I watched a little bit, you know, I had to lay down, and, you know, I take naps, you know, because I more or less have to. So I caught a little bit of the first layer of games. And then the Sunday night one, you know, I caught a good bit of that. And then the you know, after that, there was the Cowboys, Buccaneers, the Thursday game. But I was really impressed with the Cowboys, to be honest with you.
Yeah, they played good.
You know, I know they lost the game, but that they're not going to be like last year.
No, as long as Dak can stay healthy, you know, we were poised for a good season, but injuries, you know, take it a different direction. But I don't know if you saw, yep, but your Packers sure did not look good.
Oh, man. Like, The Packers played like I felt. We'll just leave it right there.
Yeah, that's funny. Did you win your fantasy game? But I don't think you did. Did you?
I did not win in the Naked Bible League. I'm not sure. Well, I think, I don't know if I have Rodgers on that team or not, but basically he had an epically bad performance, but there was somebody who just really laid an egg for me there. But my other leagues, I did okay, fine.
Those leagues don't count. I don't count those leagues.
I know.
Those are fake leagues.
I know.
But,
They're the inferior leagues, right?
I lost to your brother, so I had a good game and I still lost. So I didn't like that too much.
Yeah, well, he has a good team.
Yeah.
He usually drafts pretty well. So,
well, since we're in Revelation, these last few chapters might actually sound like heaven to be able to.
Right. Yeah. We get our revenge here talking about Armageddon.
But you're right.
That's where we're at.
Well, all right, Mike. Well, I don't want to keep you talking. If you want to jump into part two here, I'm ready if you are.
Yeah. So, in part two here in Revelation 19, we're going to cover Revelation 19, 11 through 21, which is the rest of the chapter. So I'm going to start off by reading that and then telegraph where we're going to be going here. So Revelation 19, 11, reading from the ESV says, "Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written that no one knows but himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury, the wrath of God, the Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and with a loud voice he called to all the birds that fly directly overhead, Come, gather for the great supper of God to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all men, both free and slave, both small and great. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him, who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet, who in its presence had done the signs by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur, and the rest were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and all the birds were gorged with their flesh." So that is Revelation 19:11. It's the Battle of Armageddon, and again, this is very familiar. The Old Testament references here are very easy to pick out by this point, because they're somewhat repetitious with where we've already been. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the obvious things. We have the reference to eyes like a flame of fire. Again, that was earlier in the book for the risen Christ, drawing on language from Daniel. And of course, he has many crowns. The name written, he is marked with the name of Yahweh, just like the beast. His followers are marked with the name of the beast, so on and so forth. So the name by which he's called is the Word of God. I am that I am. Most scholars, opt for that particular word here. Armies of heaven is familiar, angelic host imagery from the Old Testament. Again, very, very easy to pick out, especially for those who've read Unseen Realm. Again, following him on the white horses, we had the earlier reference to Zechariah 14, that the Lord will come with all his holy ones, again, earlier in the book. So a lot of this stuff, again, we've seen already. We've seen he will rule them with a rod of iron, which interestingly enough is applied to Jesus, the returning Christ here. But back in Revelation 3:21, or Revelation 2, I think it was 26, in this case, this particular citation, that was language spoken about us as believers. Okay, the one who overcomes, the believer who overcomes, he will rule the nations with a rod of iron. So it's this shared messianic rule Revelation 3:21, Jesus shares his throne, you know, with the one who overcomes, believers. And so that language here of a group of holy ones arrayed in white linen, well, that's us. You know, that these are the members of the divine council, the heavenly host. And we're going to get more of that in this episode and next. Just specific phrases, again, that tie into the notion, that reinforce the notion that believers are, you know, even now when we die, we become members of the council, and we just await what the Lord wants us to do. And this is part of it. You know, we are the holy ones along with the supernatural holy ones who return to earth to judge evil and destroy the gods. So, you know, a lot of this, again, is familiar territory. Where I want to focus today is really on verses 17 through 21. Believe it or not, these descriptions of the birds eating the flesh and the very brief note about the nations that are gathered again against the Lord, you know, at Jerusalem, at Har Mageddon, Har Mored, the Mount of Assembly, Jerusalem, Zion. That has something to do with deception is going to become important. These little phrases that don't seem to mean so much, again, the birds, the deception, you know, and of course this ends with the lake of fire and so on and so forth. That's actually going to become really important because of what I want to do and what I'm going to interact with here in this episode, and it will overlap into our next episode when we focus more in chapter 20. We'll hit a little bit of chapter 20 here because we have to, but in the next episode on chapter 20, there'll be more of it. So what I want to do in this episode is interact with Meredith Klein's article. Now, those of you who have read Unseen Realm in the chapter on Armageddon know that I footnote this article, and the article is entitled Har Mageddon, subtitle The End of the Millennium, and that was an article published in the Journal for the Evangelical Theological Society in 1996, specifically volume 39. Now, what I want to do here is, because Klein is, to my knowledge, the only evangelical Old Testament scholar, the only evangelical scholar, period, who recognized very clearly the fact that Har Mageddon, the mount, Har is mount. I mean, John tells us that Har Mageddon, Armageddon, is in the Hebrew tongue. Okay, Har Mageddon, mount of something. And it can't be Megiddo because there is no mountain there. Anyone who's been to the site, the first question should be to your tour guide, where is the mountain? Because there isn't any. It's a plain. So Klein, again, thought, you know, well, and this is all an Unseen Realm. We've discussed it in earlier episodes too. You know, what if we're not dealing with Hebrew MGD, you know, the first three consonants of Megiddo, and why it ends with an N? Again, you can read Unseen Realm and into the footnotes and you'll find out why. What if instead we have Har and then Mem Gayin, the other Hebrew consonant that has that G sound, like Gomorrah is actually not spelled with Hebrew G, Gimel. It's spelled with Gayin, Gomorrah. It has that back of the throat G sound. So Klein's like, well, what if we have Mem, Gayin, Dalet, and we have Har Mored? And as soon as he came to that observation, you know, the whole thing opened up, because Har Mored is the Mount of Assembly from Isaiah 14. This is where God rules. It's Zion. It's Jerusalem. And this is why the other language associated with this battle is associated with Jerusalem in the passages. Again, read Unseen Realm, you'll get all the data, or again, go back and listen to some of the comments we've had here. So Klein took this reality, this textual reality, and he went to the book of Revelation and said, okay, if this is Jerusalem, if this is a final battle for Jerusalem, where in the Old Testament do we see such a battle depicted and fought? And the obvious answer emerged pretty quickly, and that is the Gog-Magog incident of Ezekiel 38 and 39. Now, Gog and Magog are actually mentioned explicitly in Revelation 20, but we're not there yet. We're in Revelation 19. And so what Klein does in his article is he basically looks for all of the places where John in Revelation 16 through Revelation 20, you know, up to Revelation 20, And we could include Revelation 20 for the sake of our discussion here. Revelation 16 through 20, where in those passages does John repurpose and utilize the Gog-Magog elements in those chapters? And not just Gog-Magog, but other Old Testament passages that have a final climatic, climactic battle for Zion, for Jerusalem. So where does John use those passages, especially Ezekiel 38 and 39? And it turns out that John uses them in several places in all of these chapters. And so Klein says, look, there's only one way to parse this. And I agree with him as far as what's happening in the text. And that is John is describing the same conflict three or four times in these chapters. It's recapitulation. John is recycling this material to describe the climactic defeat, conflict and defeat of the beast. And he doesn't just do it in Revelation 20 when he mentions Gog Magog. He does it in chapter 19. He does it in chapter 18. He does it in chapter 17. So if you recall, as a listener to this series, I have said a few times before that most people approach the book of Revelation and they assume, there's no instruction manual at the front of the book or at the end, but they assume that we're supposed to read Revelation as a linear sequential chronology. And I've said before, there are places where that just is not the case. You can't read it that way and understand what's going on. And this is ground zero for that assertion. So Klein's article, I think, does a great job of showing how from Revelation 16 through 20, we have recapitulation. We have a repeated cycling of descriptions of the same events. We have followers of the beast getting the mark. We have the beast chaos system persecuting Christians. We have them eventually massing against Zion, the Lord, for one final battle to essentially stop the plan of God from happening. We have the return of Christ, the destruction of the beast and his system, and then we go off into the final resurrection and judgments and the kingdom return to earth. John recycles those series of events three or four, maybe five times in these chapters. They are not to be read as a linear chronology of separate events. Now, when you do this, and Klein, his subtitle of his article, The End of the Millennium, when you do this, you are forced to the conclusion that the thousand-year references in the beginning of Revelation 20 are not a future millennial rule. They are the church age. They are the present church age. And I agree with that too, with one exception that we'll hit at the end of this episode and on into Revelation 20. There's something Klein has missed that I'm going to point out to you. But Klein was an amillennialist, and so he uses this information to destroy the premillennial eschatological system. And that's what I want to track on today. I want to, again, I'm telling you, telegraphing this all up front. I hope that by the end of this episode and the next, you will see the importance of not attaching your theology, or not, let me put it this way, not equating biblical theology with a theological system. Because if you do that, you have no literal kingdom to look forward to. Klein successfully destroys the standard premillennial understanding of Revelation 16 through 20. He does it by virtue of how the Old Testament is used by John over and over and over and over again in cycles. You cannot read it as a linear chronology. It doesn't work. So that's going to leave us with a question at the end of this episode that Klein has to answer and all systems have to answer. I'm going to propose my own answer in the following episode. But I'm just telling you where we're going. It's going to sound confusing. Well, if I'm just reading the book of Revelation, Mike, the chapters follow each other, and this is a series of events. One just happens after the other. No, it doesn't, and I'm going to show you why, using Klein's work here, how John is reproducing the same passages different times in these Revelation chapters. Now, to sort of understand where Klein's going with this, we need to summarize a little bit of some Revelation content to this point. And I'm going to go all the way back to chapter 6, Revelation 6 through 18. So if you look, let's just take the seal judgments. The first four of the seven seal judgments are in Revelation 6, and they're very general. They follow the description of Jesus, you know, that he gave his disciples, that his followers would be persecuted. If you read Mark 13, 3 through 13, it's going to sound remarkably like the first four seal judgments of Revelation 6. That's not an accident. Okay, John and Mark are they're tracking together. In fact, I will read you this one passage. Let's go to Mark 13 just to make the point of how this really sounds. So we've got Mark 13, beginning in verse 3. This is Jesus on the Mount of Olives, the signs of the end of the age. Now just listen to this. As he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?" And Jesus began to say to them, "See that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginning of the birth pains. Be on your guard, for they will deliver you over to councils. You will be beaten in synagogues. You will stand before governors and kings for my sake, to bear witness before them." Okay, all of that, every one of those elements you'll find in Revelation 6 going forward, every one of them. And then we hit verse 10 in Mark 13, and the gospel must first be proclaimed to all the nations. There we go again, linking the return of the Lord to the fullness of the Gentiles. "And when they bring you to trial and deliver you over, do not be anxious beforehand what you are to say, but whatever is given you in that hour, you know, that is what you say. For it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will deliver brother over to death, and father his child. Children will rise against parents. You will be hated for all my name's sake, but the one who endures to the end." Oh, doesn't that sound like the book of Revelation? "He that overcomes to the end will be saved." You know, and then you hit, you know, the abomination and so on and so forth. So the point is that you could go back to these discourses in the Gospels and look at what Jesus said would happen before his coming, and you'll find all of it in the book of Revelation. So the seal judgments are very general in sort of laying, you know, beginning the first of these three cycles of judgments. The fifth seal unleashes a response to the martyrdom of the followers of the Lamb. So God, you know, starts, you know, taking revenge against the persecution of his followers. The sixth seal is the end of the cosmos as humanity knows it. It's classic Old Testament language for the dissolution of the heavens. And the seventh seal, remember that was in Revelation 8, that was silence in heaven. And there was a lot of Sinai imagery. And commentators pretty much, you know, land on the idea that the silence is there because those who see what's about to come are aghast. They're shocked at what's going to happen when God unleashes his revenge at the day of the Lord right before Jesus' return. They're shocked. So we've got this general judgment, and then we've got, you know, again, this silence about what's going to happen. And then we get the trumpet judgment. So this is the next cycle. There are numerous parallels to the Egyptian plagues, as we've already noticed. In trumpets 1 through 4, the first four echo the first four seal judgments. So right there, if you compare the first four trumpets to the first four seal judgments, there's repetition. There's repetition. And, you know, again, it's going to be general judgment on the earth. There's your Exodus elements. But the judgments, the seals, and the trumpets narrow to God's punishment of those who are persecuting his followers. Those who believe in him, it's a response again to their martyrdom. So the followers of the beast start to get, pardon the pun, marked. They're in the crosshairs for judgment. And eventually everything leads up to a final climactic battle, which is Armageddon. So in the case of the trumpets, you've got again general plagues, first four. The fifth trumpet is the release of the watchers in Revelation 9. And this gives us the spiritual chaos element of the end of days, you know, as opposed to just human destruction, human, you know, persecution of Christians. Now, we see there's a supernatural element behind it. In later chapters, this fifth slot, you know, or this spiritual supernatural chaos slot will be filled by the beast himself, the harlot of Babylon, the whole Babylon system. The sixth trumpet is the drying up of the Euphrates. Again, it's not about China. It's a massive army from quote-unquote Babylon. They are the world chaos enemy. As we've talked in the preceding two or three episodes here, everything points to Babylon, which is expected because Babylon, the rebellion back at the Tower of Babel is where we get the nations who align themselves with other gods against the true God. This is just axiomatic. The Deuteronomy 32 worldview just provides the perfect framework for this. So the sixth trumpet is the drying up of the Euphrates, the massive army from quote-unquote Babylon, gathers against the people of God, preparing to confront Zion. And this is Harmageddon, the battle that occurs at the Mount of Assembly, Yahweh's mountain, which is Zion. The seventh trumpet heralds the kingdom of God. Well, that's logical because after Armageddon, that's what happens next. You know, we're going to have the general resurrection, the righteous to life, the unrighteous to death. And then we get the kingdom returned to earth in full consummation. The king, you know, Revelation 11:15 about the seventh trumpet. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Again, the trumpets repeat a cycle that we saw with the seals. There's the same general flow of events, and they borrow imagery from Egyptian plague stuff, from Sinai stuff, from Babylon stuff in the Old Testament. John is cycling through the same set of ideas. Now, you know, if you note, if you remember back in our discussion of the 144,000 in Revelation 7, that was, you know, the 144,000, we sort of landed on these are Jewish followers of Jesus, but that's not to exclude a great multitude of Gentiles, because in Revelation 7:9, you know, we get a reference to those who would not be numbered among the Jews. It's just it's a more generic reference to nations. Then collectively, that multitude are believers who endure to the end. They don't give up the faith, and they have a home in the New Eden. Their description is distinct, the Gentile element, from the 144,000. So the idea that this is only Jews, you know, is not correct. I mean, you get both sides going on in the saved remnant. It's not only the 144,000. There are multitudes from the nations that also refuse to follow the beast and wind up on the Lord's side. So the 144,000, again, could be either Jewish followers of Jesus or Old Testament language of Israel applied to the church, again, which includes Jewish believers. But again, I kind of like the giving the Jewish element its due and then looping in the Gentiles, you know, through verse 9. But anyway, my point here is that the assembling of the army of the beast against this group, again, is a precursor to Armageddon and the kingdom. And both Jewish and Gentile believers are in the picture somewhere. They're both being targeted. John does this because he elsewhere frequently applies Old Testament Israel language to the church. The most obvious, of course, is Exodus 19:6, its kingdom of priests. He refers to the church as the kingdom of priests, the church including Gentiles, in Revelation 1:6, Revelation 5:10, and Revelation 20, verse 6. So to view Revelation 7 as some sort of only Jewish thing is a mistake. And I mention it because you'll see this in dispensational systems. Again, you cannot exclude the Gentile element from the saved and sanctified, those who choose to follow the Lord, you know, before the end of the days. And now that fits wonderfully if a lot of this is about the present age, because the present age we have the church, and the church is circumcision neutral. So again, there's a consistency here, but I wanted to just throw that out because some of you are going to be thinking that right away. You need to go back and listen to the Revelation 7, you know, episodes. So what about some of the patterning to this point? Again, there's judgment on the earth. Again, very general. And it's going to funnel specifically to those who align themselves with the beast. Believers are quote unquote sealed and protected if we follow the Exodus imagery to its consistent point. Whether this means protection from any physical harm is debated, and the Egyptian parallels might suggest that, but not all the judgments have Egyptian plague parallels. Some of them don't. So we can't be, you know, really hard and fast about that either. But at the least, it seems to denote more consistently protection from evil spirits. In other words, the protection and sealing that goes on at the end of days is really about keeping believers loyal to the gospel, preventing them, you know, assisting them, helping them to not surrender the faith, helping them to overcome. It shouldn't be viewed as a guarantee against physical harm. Rather, it's supernatural assistance to overcome, to stay with the faith, to keep believing. Beale and Campbell, this is Beale's, they have a shorter version of Beale's commentary. These two guys, Beale, and then he had editorial help from Campbell, put together, they write this in that particular volume. The demonic powers are forbidden to harm those with the seal of God on their forehead. Uppermost in John's mind is not physical security, but protection of the unbeliever, or protection of the believers, faith and salvation, from the various sufferings and persecutions that are inflicted upon them, whether by Satan or his demonic and earthly agents. The sealing enables God's people to respond in faith to the trials through which they pass, so that these trials become the very instruments by which they are strengthened in their faith. Again, I think that's well said. I think it's important. This is all preparation for Armageddon. It's all preparation for the final conflict, the final judgment of human and cosmic evil, the final reversal of chaos. He that endures to the end will be saved. He that endures to the end will judge, you know, the nations. He'll rule the nations with a rod of iron. He that endures to the end, I will share my throne with him. Okay, this is all meant to encourage loyalty, believing loyalty to the gospel. Then you get to the bowl judgments. The bowl judgments are the fodder for Revelation 16. First three bowls draw on the language of the Egyptian plagues again, just like the trumpets did. They recycle the first four trumpet judgments. There we go. It's not a linear chronology. It's recycling. The fourth and fifth bowl judgments seem to be a reverse of the plague of darkness we talked about earlier, because it has people scorched by the sun, and in keeping with the Egyptian plague of darkness, which is bowl number five. It is with this judgment that the connections from Egypt as chaos agent in the Old Testament sort of transferred to Babylon, you know, because Babylon becomes the arch rival and arch enemy as biblical history moves on. It's in this judgment that sort of transition is most apparent. Babylon, of course, becomes a code name for Rome, because Rome in John's day, when he's writing the book of Revelation, they, not literal Babylon, but they are the primary chaos agent. They have inherited that status from Babylon. But everybody, you know, that when John writes, when he talks about Babylon, everybody knows what he's talking about. God's archenemy. Now, you know, we're going to use this to portray the Roman Empire. And we talked about how that has to be because the inauguration of the kingdom of God in Daniel 2, and Daniel 7, of course, but Daniel 2, the stone made without hands, happens in the day of the last kingdom, which is Rome. Okay? So again, all of this fits. Now, Beale and Campbell draw attention to this, to one particular thing they write. This punishment of the fourth bowl, occurring prior to the reign of Christ, anticipates the final judgment of Babylon, which also will be burned by fire, in other words, scorched with fire, in Revelation 17, 16, and 18, 8. There it's burned up with fire. So that's an important link. Again, that sort of, again, links these judgments together, these three different groups of judgments. There are threads that link them together. The sixth bowl explicitly references the drying of the Euphrates to make way for the kings of the east, which is a clear reference to Babylon and its hordes, both human and demonic. Specifically, Revelation 16, 12 through 15 describe the demonic element of the Babylon chaos system. So, and in verse 16, we get to the end of chapter 16, John learns the hordes are being gathered at Har-Mageddon. So that brings us to Armageddon. Again, these judgments, these three sets of judgments are recycling each other. They tell the same basic storyline of who the enemy is, the persecution of believers, God pouring out his wrath on the earth generally, and then more particularly on those who take the mark. The reaction from those is anger. We're gonna confront Yahweh at Zion. We're gonna put an end to this. We're not gonna let Yahweh have his way, his plan. We're gonna gather together against, you know, Zion, against him and Zion. We are gonna stop him. That's what we're gonna do. And again, that's Armageddon. And then as we get into chapter 19, of course, they are defeated dramatically by the returning Jesus with us, with believers. And then, you know, the rest again leads off into the final judgments and the new, you know, new Eden return to earth. Again, it's a familiar storyline repeated through chapter 16 through 20. And that brings us to Klein. Okay, so I'm going to be pulling some points from his article, but most of the detail remains there, and his article is in the protected folder if you want to read it. So we've seen in this summary that the seal judgment set up the trumpets, again, which are largely recycled in the bowls. And it's this recycling that draws the attention of many interpreters of Revelation. Scholars have noticed this, many of them, because it continues into Revelation 17, 18, 19, and 20. So we're going to focus on Harmo-Aid, Harmageddon, the Mount of Assembly, and how that specifically gets repeated. Not just, you know, just because Gog and Magog are referenced in Revelation 20, verse 8, doesn't mean that's the first time we see the battle. We see elements of Ezekiel 38 and 39 before we ever get to Revelation 20. And that's what Klein noticed. So after we get this in our heads that Harmageddon is Zion and Jerusalem, and Klein again follows the same bunny trail that I do in Unseen Realm. If you need a review of that material, you can go back and read it. But I'm just going to give you what Klein says here. It's kind of a short form summary. He writes this. He says, following the trail of Harmageddon back to Harmogade has led us to examine a set of Old Testament passages containing the phrase Yarkate Tsafon. That's in English, that's the heights of the north. Okay. From the first two of those occurrences, Isaiah 14 and in Psalm 48, verses 1 and 2, it has appeared that Harmogade, Harmageddon, is identifiable with Mount Zaphon or Mount Zion. And right away, we know we're dealing with cosmic geography, because Jerusalem, Zion, is not located in the north of the land, is it? Jerusalem is in Judah. It's in the south. But nevertheless, it's called the Heights of the North in Psalm 48, 1 and 2. Heights of the North, the Yarkate Tsafon. The Harmo-Aid in Canaanite literature was Baal's mountain. This is the reference, you know, back in Isaiah 14, where you have the rebel, again, and Baal becomes the Satan figure, says, I will be like the Most High. I will be above the stars of God. You know, I will sit as ruler at the Mount of Assembly, in the heights of the north. So this notion that in the cosmic north, again, and in Canaanite, it was linked geographically, you know, to a specific mountain that's far distant from Jerusalem. This is this, you know, it's either Hermon or Jebel el-Akhra, and it's probably both depending on what passage you're in. But this is the seat of the power of the gods. And so the psalmist in Psalm 48 says, I'm sorry, but the real cosmic center is not this place. Psalm 68. Yahweh says, I'm going to take it captive. It belongs to me. You know, and of course, Paul quotes Psalm 68 and Ephesians 4 about the leading captivity captive, all that stuff. It's in Unseen Realm. So we have a spiritual competition between the cosmic mountain in Canaanite and all the way back to Sumerian theology and the place where Yahweh has chosen to put his name, which is Zion. Psalm 48 refers to Zion with all the terminology that his supernatural enemies, Yahweh's supernatural enemies, use for their dominion. It'd be like if it's the Lord of the Rings, it'd be like Gondor, you know, Aragorn, who's the Christ figure, you know, saying, no, you know, Mordor is nothing. Gondor is really the cosmic center here. And he would start, you know, using Mordor epithets of Gondor just to stick it in the eye, you know, of Sauron. This is what you have going on here in biblical, you know, biblical setting. So Psalm 48 refers to Zion, which is in the south, as the heights of the north. So back to Klein. This is all part of his argument. He says Ezekiel 38 and 39 is another passage. It's the third passage, in addition to Isaiah 14 and Psalm 48. And here we discover a fundamental correspondence between the Zaphon, Magedon, and Gog-Magog concepts. He says these concepts get married in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Klein writes, that means that the Harmageddon crisis of Revelation 16, verses 14 through 16, and the series of parallel passages in Revelation, is to be identified with the millennium-ending Gog-Magog event of Revelation 20, 7 through 10. He's saying, look, all of these cycles need to be seen for what they are. They're cycles, and the final cycle is Revelation 20. It's not we can't read this as a linear sequence of different events. It's a repetition of the same events. Klein says, the Revelation 20 passage is replete with allusions to Ezekiel 38 and 39, including, along with the explicit mention, by name, of Gog and Magog, the distinctive central theme of Ezekiel 38 and 39, which is the universal gathering of the world forces to destroy God's people and their catastrophic overthrow by the descent of fiery judgment from heaven. Accordingly, it is generally acknowledged that Ezekiel's prophecy and the vision of the loosing of Satan after the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 describe the same eschatological event. Lots of scholars land here because it's obvious. You don't have John in Revelation 20 coming up with a different Gog and Magog other than the one in Ezekiel 38 and 39. That's ridiculous. And everybody knows it. But again, there are people who would try to evade this because they want to read Revelation as a linear sequence of events here, and it doesn't work. You have to literally make up a second Gog-Magog event or ignore all the Ezekiel 38 and 39 language in Revelation 16 through 19. Just pretend it's not there. So as this is my comment, now just getting away from Klein a little bit. Again, I just want to press the point. We have to get away from this in this section of the book of Revelation, this notion of we have a neat linear chronology. Basically, we don't. And we have to look at the recycling. The recapitulation is clear in many places. So what Klein does is he starts with a clear connection between Revelation 16, that's sort of the beginning of the section, and then Revelation 20. That's how he does it in his article. So let's take a look at that. Klein writes, a main consideration in establishing the identity of the Revelation 16 Harmageddon crisis. Remember, Revelation 16 is where you specifically get the term used, Harmageddon. We need to establish the identity of the Revelation 16 Harmageddon crisis and the Ezekiel 38-39 Gog crisis. So he says, if we can do that, if we can link Revelation 16 to Ezekiel 38 and 39, then it's much easier to link all of that to Revelation 20 because Gog and Magog are mentioned by name. So this is his goal. He says the Antichrist element is common to both Revelation 16 and Ezekiel 38-39. The Antichrist identity of the dragon-like beast in the Harmageddon episode would be acknowledged by most interpreters, irrespective of their millennial preferences. For the continuity of this beast of Revelation 16 with the fourth beast of Daniel 7 in the final phase of the little horn expression is obvious, and it is. And in Daniel, an alternative representation of this bestial eschatological foe is the self-deifying king of Daniel 11, 36. Again, all the systems know this too. Everybody agrees on this. This is the figure interpreted by Paul as the Antichrist in 2 Thessalonians 2, 4. It remains now to show that the Antichrist element is also conspicuously present in Ezekiel 38 and 39. So Klein says, let's go. And here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to summarize his lines of evidence for this. So just so you know where he's going, where we're going, is we're taking the obvious. We'll start with the obvious that all of the eschatological systems agree on. When we read Revelation 16, we get all this Antichrist stuff. We know it relates to Daniel 2. We know it relates to Daniel 7. We know it relates to the little horn. We know it relates to Daniel 11:36, the figure that makes himself God. And we know that Paul picks up on that very idea in 2 Thessalonians 2:4 to describe the Antichrist. Everybody knows all those elements. Everybody agrees. So what Klein says, what remains, what people just don't do, including scholars, is they don't look back at Ezekiel 38 and 39 and see how that passage is used by John in Revelation 16 to reinforce, to articulate his Antichrist Armageddon story, his prophecy. That's what they don't see. And so what Klein says, come along with me. Let's look where Ezekiel 38 and 39, and, you know, maybe Psalm 48 a little bit, some of these other passages, where they're used in Revelation 16. So this is where he starts. So here's his first line of evidence. Where does Gog hail from? Where does he come from? Well, Klein says, let's think about the heights of the north. Psalm 48 relates the marshaling of enemy forces against Zion in that passage. So let me read you Psalm 48. And if you've read Unseen Realm, this should be familiar. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. Obviously, Jerusalem. His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of all the earth. Mount Zion in the Yarkate Tzafon, in the far north, the city of the great king. Even though Jerusalem, Zion is in the south, we're going to say it's in the far north because we're doing theology. The psalmist is doing theology and cosmic geography. He's not doing literal geography. He's doing cosmic geography to do theology. Here's verse 3. Within her, Jerusalem's citadels, God has made himself known as a fortress. For behold, the kings assembled as they came on together. As soon as they saw it, they were astounded. They were in panic. They took to flight. Trembling took hold of them there, anguish as of a woman in labor. Okay. By the east wind, you shattered the ships of Tarshish. I love the reference to Tarshish there. Basically, everybody's gathered against Zion. We're not going to forget about little Tarshish, you know, Spain. They get in on the act too. As we have heard, so we have seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, which God will establish forever. So we're preparing for battle. It's all the nations against Zion in the heights of the north. Cosmic geography, okay? So Klein says, you know, okay, let's notice that. You get the heights of the north, Zion's in the far north. Then he says, Gog, lo and behold, who would have thought? Gog is also from the Yarkate Tzafon. Okay, the language, the phrase is used in Ezekiel 38:6, Ezekiel 38:15, Ezekiel 39:2. Klein writes, it is from the heights of Tzafon that God brings Gog with all his enemies to overthrow them on the mountains of Israel, and specifically at Zion. So there's one connection. Okay. So first line of evidence is, where does Gog come from? Lo and behold, again, it sounds a lot like what's going on, the gathering of the nations, you know, from the north. Gog's characterization, number two, as a usurper of the Har Moged, the place of council. Now, we know this from Isaiah 14. The cosmic rebel seeks to ascend the heights of Tzafon and be the Most High. Thus, the great eschatological enemy in Revelation 16:16 marches on the heights of the north, Zion. Again, we're seeing Isaiah 14 repeated at Armageddon. Interestingly enough, Isaiah 14 is directed against, drumroll please, not the Chinese, not the Russians, but the king of Babylon, whereby the prophet uses the cosmic rebellion story to portray this king. In Revelation, the enemy is Babylon and the beast. Klein writes, Gog is characterized by the Antichrist syndrome. I love that phrase. He is a pretender to the throne of heaven. The correspondence of his experience to the king of Babylon typology in Isaiah 14 is seen in the ironic motif of the polar contrast between his pretensions and his actual fate, like 180 degrees different. Glenn writes, challenging Yahweh's sovereignty on Zion, Gog would take possession of the mountain heights of Israel. But he ends up with his vast military array in the depths of a valley. He lunged for a heavenly throne, but plunged into a netherworld grave. Remember Isaiah 14? I'll be like the Most High. But he's brought into Sheol. Now, on this point about, can we really call the valley where Gog and Magog, and we read Ezekiel 38 and 39, where Gog's armies end up in this valley, is that really a netherworld grave? Is that really the underworld? You know, like, is that really cosmic? Oh, yeah. Klein writes, the valley where his armies were buried is called the Valley of the Ovarim in Ezekiel 39 to 11, literally, those passing through or passing across. That is a term used for the dead, those who cross over from this world to the next. It appears in Job 34:20, Psalm 144:4. Another name given to the burial valley in Ezekiel 39:11 is Ge-Hamon Gog, Valley of the Multitude of Gog. Now, this netherworld grave description is legit, if only from Ezekiel 39:11. But the word translated travelers in that passage in ESV, those who pass through or pass across, the word Ovarim is significant. I'm going to read from DDD, the Dictionary of Deities and Demons. Okay. Here's what their entry on this term, the travelers, the Ovarim, says in part. The participle cal plural Ovarim of the verb avar, to pass from one side to the other, seems to have a special meaning in the context of the cult of the dead, denoting the spirits of the dead crossing the border between the land of the living and the world of the dead. It can be interpreted as a divine name in Ezekiel 38, or 39:11 and 39:14, which may have also been preserved in the geographical named Avarim. This is Numbers 21:10 and 11, 27:12, 33:44, 33:47 through 48, Deuteronomy 32:49, and Jeremiah 22:20. In Ezekiel 39:14, the word indicates the dead, just dead bodies, okay? A possible solution to this crux interpretum is to relate Ovarim here and in verse 11 to the Ovarim mentioned in the Ugaritic text denoting the spirits of the dead. So it's not just dead bodies. It's also a term that is used in wider Canaanite literature for the spirits of the dead. The Valley of the Ovarim is located, quote, east of the sea. That's Ezekiel 39:11, which is very likely the Dead Sea. So it was part of the Transjordan. This is a region which shows many traces of ancient cults of the dead, such as the megalithic monuments called dolmens and place names referring to the dead and the netherworld, such as Ovot, which means the spirits of the dead, Peor, as in Baal of Peor, and Avari. That's the end of the entry. If you have read my demons book, or I think even I do this in the angels book, that the passage in Jude about Michael contending with the devil for the body of Moses, this is the key to understanding that. Because where Moses dies and is buried, remember, he never gets into the promised land. He is buried in a place associated with the netherworld, the realm of the dead, the spirits of the dead. And so there was a strong tradition growing out of the burial place and the Old Testament terminology. You know, it was a dark place. There developed this tradition about, is Moses okay? What happened to Moses' body? Like, what is? And so Michael, who is the prince of Israel, is the one who, quote unquote, rescues or protects Moses from the Lord of the Dead. This is the place where Gog is defeated and his troops wind up. Does it sound like Isaiah 14? The answer is yes. Okay, so that's thread number two. Thread number three, Klein says, well, what about the destination of Gog? We've talked about where Gog hails from. You know, where does he come from? We've talked about him having the Antichrist complex, that I'm going to go conquer, you know, the cosmic mountain. I'm going to go defeat Yahweh. That doesn't turn out so well for him. What about the destination of Gog? Ezekiel 38 and 39 make this quite clear. Where is Gog headed? Klein writes, Gog advances against the mountains of Israel, 39:2, 39:17, Ezekiel. It is God's chosen Mount Zion in the heart of those mountains that is his central point of attack. As in the case of the mustering of the bestial armies in Revelation 16, the destination and intended target for Gog and his hosts is Harmageddon, where the Lord's anointed is enthroned at his right hand. The indications for this are clear. Even though Zion is not mentioned by name in Ezekiel 38 and 39, God does speak of the mountains of Israel as my mountains, 38:21, and of the land of Israel as my land, 38:16. Implicit in that is the royal mountain city where Yahweh dwells and rules over the mountainous domains he claims as his own. Also, such a capital city on the cosmic mountain was regarded as the center of the earth. And we've talked about this. Let me just interrupt Klein here. We've talked about this before, about cosmic mountain terminology, Eden, Tabernacle, Temple, Sinai. These places were viewed as the place where heaven and earth intersect. They are the center of the earth, not in terms of actual physical geography, but they are the center of the earth in that this is the place from which God runs things. Okay, so back to Klein, he says, in 38:12, Gog is described as scheming to assault the people of God dwelling at, quote, the center, literally the navel of the earth, unquote. In that concept, Gog's real objective is exposed, Yahweh's Mount of Assembly, rival to Gog's pseudo-Tzaphon. In the Revelation 20 version of Ezekiel 38 and 39, Gog's armies are explicitly said to compass, quote, the beloved city, unquote, okay, which is Jerusalem and Zion. Trajectory number 4. What about Gog in Revelation 20? Klein summarizes this point as follows. He says, in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10, the Gog-Magog assault on Zion marks the end of the millennium. Within Ezekiel 38 and 39, indications also abound of the eschatological finality of the Gog crisis. As in Revelation 20, it comes after a long age of secure preservation for God's people, Ezekiel 38:8. In New Testament terms, after the age in which the church, though sorely persecuted, is preserved by the Lord to complete the Great Commission task, Revelation 11:7. And as the judgment on Gog in Revelation 20 merges with the resurrection of the dead for final judgment, that's Revelation 20, verses 11 through 15, so God's judicial deliverance of his people from Gog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 institutes for them the eternal state of unending, never again disturbed felicity, described in Ezekiel 39, 21 through 29. So Klein has laid out 4 trajectories that align Revelation 16, okay, Armageddon, with Ezekiel 38 and 39. They're all clear. They all make sense. Again, if you're reading the passage in light of John's use of the Old Testament, you know, if you're not doing that, then you're making something up. You're talking about Russia and China or something like that. Well, go ahead. I can't stop you. But, you know, John isn't quoting from Mao Zedong. Okay, or, you know, something that Lenin wrote or Marx. He's quoting from the Old Testament. He's quoting from Ezekiel 38 and 39 and Psalm 48, a little bit of, you know, Zechariah 14, some Daniel. Okay. John's use of the Old Testament tells us how to read chapters 16 through 19. So you might ask, well, how does this connect to Revelation 19 specifically? Because that's where we are here in this episode. As all interpreters of the book agree, Revelation 19, 11 through 21, which we read at the beginning, is the outcome of the Great War against the beast. It's the outcome of Armageddon. It describes the climactic battle won by the returning Christ, the messianic warrior and judge. Revelation 19 repurposes descriptive content from the Gog and Magog battle in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Revelation 19 does it too. It's not just Revelation 16. So Klein writes, Instruments of judgment mentioned by both Ezekiel and John include earthquakes, Ezekiel 38, 19, and 20. Again, align that with not only Revelation 16, 18 through 20, but earlier in the book. Sword, Ezekiel 38, 21, see Revelation 19, 15, and 21. And destructive hail and fiery brimstone, Ezekiel 38, 22, Ezekiel 39, verse 6. Align that with Revelation 16, 21 and Revelation 19, 20. Most striking, Klein says, is the distinctive motif of God's summoning the birds and beasts to feed on the carcasses of the defeated enemies Gog had gathered. The banquet theme elaborated in Ezekiel 39, 4 and Ezekiel 39, 17 through 20. And John incorporates that passage, Ezekiel 39, 4 and 17 through 20. He specifically incorporates that into the account of Christ's victory over the beast and his assembled armies in Revelation 19, 17 through 18. You will look in vain. Okay, you will look in vain to find some other passage in the Old Testament where we have the birds and the beasts summoned to feed on the carcasses of the dead at the cosmic mountain. There is only one passage that does that in the Old Testament, and it's Ezekiel 39. It's Gog and Magog. So that is how Revelation 19 connects. So we've seen Revelation 16, 17, 17 and 18 are really about the beast. Specifically, Revelation 16 and 19 repeat, repurpose, recapitulate content from Ezekiel 38 and 39, the Gog and Magog event, before we even get to Revelation 20, where Gog and Magog are mentioned by name. So we've got a repetition cycle between chapter 16, chapter 19, and chapter 20. They're describing the same series of events. It is not a linear chronology of three separate events. It is a recycling of one event three times. And if you do that, what it means, before you get to Gog and Magog in Revelation 20, before you hit there, you get all these references to the 1,000 years. If they're describing the same thing, then those 1,000 years must represent the believers of chapter 16 and the believers, the believing age in chapter 16, the believing age in chapter 19. It's the current present age. Now, to put it lightly, all of this cannot be coincidence. Now, Klein uses the very clear recycling again in his mind to devastate premillennial eschatology. And this is what I was raised on, pre-trib rapture, premillennial, return of Jesus, literal 1,000-year kingdom, so on and so forth. And Klein, by virtue of his skill ferreting out of how John uses Ezekiel 38 and 39 in more than one place in these chapters, destroys that system. Doesn't really destroy a rapture question. I mean, that's a little bit different of a question, but it destroys the system, the general premillennial system. And he's happy to do so because he's an amillennialist. Now, I would say, well, Professor Klein, as much as I love you and your article, that's kind of a yes and no. what does this all mean? We're gonna wrap the episode with a few of these observations. What does this all mean? Well, the Old Testament use of John by Ezekiel 38 and 39 in chapters that precede the second coming. Notice that it preceded the return of the Lord, because the return of the Lord, marks the climax of Armageddon. And the chapter, and it's also done, Ezekiel 38 and 39 are also in the chapters that follow the second coming, Revelation 20. This forces the conclusion that the kingdom language up through Revelation 20 is basically the present church age. Now, you can't really argue out of that, because you'd have to have two battles of Armageddon, not one. Okay. You'd have to have two Gog and Magog events, not one. It doesn't make any sense. There's only one Armageddon. There's one battle for Zion. There's one return of, there's one second coming. And, there's one Gog and Magog battle. So that's point. That's point number one. That's what it means. This is where you're driven by the text. Now, that in turn produces an eschatology. Here's point number two. That has the present age, the church age, headed toward Armageddon. Well, there's no surprise there. I mean, pretty much everybody would track with that. But Ah Millers, like Klein, will use the abstraction of 1,000 years. See, we told you, 1,000 years doesn't mean a literal 1,000 years. It just means a long time because the church has been around for more than 1,000 years. So it's an abstract idea. So amillennialists like Klein will use that abstraction in Revelation 20 to abstract everything else out of existence. Like a real antichrist. Does Klein believe that there will be a real personal antichrist? I'm not sure. A lot of amillennialists don't. How about a real concerted chaos system driven by real supernatural beings? Well, we already know a lot of people in the evangelical world, and unfortunately mostly in the Reformed context where you'll find amillennialism, they don't believe that. That's too weird. It's too supernatural. You know, give us our core doctrines of the faith, and that's the supernaturalism we have. We don't want any more. So we know that happens. Third, how about the real release of demonic supernatural forces in Revelation 9? Well, most amillennialists would not say that's the release of the watchers. Again, that's too weird. Because if we said that, then we'd have to affirm Genesis 6. God forbid. How about the real reinheritance of the nations and the real fulfillment of the Psalm 82 judgment of the real rebel gods? Well, we know they don't want to touch Psalm 82. How about the real literal transformation of the earth back to a real Edenic state in real time? A lot of amillennialists don't want to go there either. The church is the present age, and then the Lord comes, and then we have the eternal state somewhere. It's this ethereal existence. And all this talk about the new earth and the new Eden, well, that's just flowery, allegorical language for something, for heaven, somewhere. I don't know. In other words, Klein and others will use the abstraction here to create a safe eschatological system for people who don't want to affirm these other quote-unquote bizarre supernatural elements. I don't. Okay, if you're wondering what their justification of such a dual hermeneutic might be, ask one of them. You know, not me, because I'm not the traditional amillennialist. Now, third observation about what all this means. Again, Klein targets premillennialism with this, but all he really destroys is the traditional definition of premillennialism. That's all he actually destroys. Pay attention carefully here to what I'm saying here. This is important. I mean, the rest of it's important, but this is important especially. If premillennialism means, quote, the system that takes Revelation as a linear chronology and bases its idea of a literal reign of Christ on earth only on the language of Revelation 20 verses 1 through 6, well, yeah, then Klein has destroyed that. But what if we ditch the millennial language? What if we focus instead on the Messiah literally ruling and reigning on earth without depending or even caring about the 1,000-year language? See, then the literal kingdom idea is alive and well, but it doesn't conform to our theological systems. Now, you already know this is where I'm at. Okay, my view of the literal earthly kingdom is the one that follows Armageddon and the final judgments, final resurrection, final judgments. It is the new Eden, and it is not 1,000 years. It is forever. 1,000 years doesn't cut it. 1,000 years is a blink of an eye for the reign of Christ on earth. But we're so bound to this language and bound to a word in Revelation 20 that when somebody like Klein comes along and shows us that we can't read Revelation 20 as a linear sequential chronology, and he destroys the system, we think, oh, I can't believe in a literal kingdom anymore. We might as well all just, you know, suck up to Klein and be amillennialists. No. Now, the church age is the kingdom inaugurated when Eden returns to earth, really, in real time. That is the consummation of the kingdom, and it is not 1,000 years. It is forever. Klein has not touched that idea. He destroys a system. He does not destroy a point of biblical theology. Now, I would also add to this as a footnote, Klein actually doesn't undo even the traditional premillennial system talk entirely, because there's one reference to a 1,000-year reign for which his use of the data does not account. And that's in Revelation 20, verse 6. I'll get there in a moment. But the larger point here is that we ought to just ditch the traditional language. Folks, there is no cosmic rule that says you have to articulate your theology using a glossary from a theology book or a theological system. There's no penalty flag that's going to come out if you say things like, well, I don't really care if 1,000 years in Revelation 20 are the church age. I still believe that there's going to be a literal kingdom reign of Christ on earth. There's no penalty flag for that. Now, you're going to have people try to throw one because they can't think outside their box. What I'm saying is, don't care about their boxes. Again, some scholars just can't do this. And on a personal note here, they can't imagine living outside the boxes that traditional Christian theological schemes have made for us to play in. This is why even scholars, again, who, you know, they can't think outside the box their seminary training gives them, will call me, Mike, yours truly, an amillennialist. Like the recent reviewer of my Demons book in the Master's Seminary Journal. The guy calls me an amillennialist. I'm not an amillennialist because I'm using traditional terms now. Amillennialists deny that there will be a literal messianic kingdom on earth. I don't. For amillennialists, the kingdom is the church now and then an ethereal, eternal state forever, somewhere, in some form. They take the New Eden imagery as figurative, not literal. Again, I don't. So what if we ditch the language and tear apart the sandbox? Knock it down. My position is that when all this plays out on earth, that Christ will literally return, literally defeat the beast. In my view, that probably speaks more of a chaos system than a man, but I do think it includes a man. I think there will be a real Antichrist. And then Christ will literally reign forever on earth in a new global Eden. This is why I say 1,000-year kingdom is too short. Christ's kingdom on earth doesn't end after 1,000 years. We don't transition from the church age here and now to some sort of undefinable, non-literal reign somewhere in the clouds that the New Testament writers mistakenly described as earthly. It's too bad that I believe that defining an idea like the messianic kingdom by one word, the word 1,000, in Revelation 20, is a flawed approach. It's a system word and is no replacement to a biblical theological idea. So sorry, I'm not playing the word game. Theology should not derive from words that theologians coin or systems theologians create using words they find in the Bible. It should derive from biblical theological data, and the data pool here is a lot wider than Revelation 20. My actual view is far from traditional amillennialism, maybe as far as you can get without being an atheist. And I'm sorry, if you can't think outside your box, that's too bad. I might shed a tear for you, but probably not. Now, again, as we wrap up here, there's an obvious question to all this that Klein has to answer. Klein is deceased. I mean, he can't, you know, respond to it, obviously, now. But all of the systems have to, especially if you're a traditional amillennialist. Everybody has, you know, anyone who's not in the traditional premillennial camp has to account for this question. Now, I'm going to tell you what the question is because it's going to be the focus of our next episode. So here we go. Now, if the kingdom language from Revelation 16 through 20 is basically about the present church age, headed toward Armageddon and toward the return of Jesus, then what is said about Satan in Revelation 20, 1 through 7 becomes an issue. Now listen to this. I'm going to read Revelation 20, first seven verses. Then I saw, and I'm going to add a few, you know, thoughts in here just to make the point clear. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. In other words, he bound him for the length of the church age, and threw him into the pit, and shut it, and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer, until the 1,000 years were ended. In other words, until the length of the church age had ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Okay, that's part of the Armageddon event. Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom the authority to judge was committed. Also I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. In other words, the dead in Christ during the length of the church age get resurrected and they reign with Christ. Well, they can't reign with Christ in a literal king because we're amillennial. Maybe, I get it. Those who were martyred, they are alive in heaven. And so during the length of the church age, they're ruling in heaven. That's actually what most amillennialists believe, by the way. Verse 5, the rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. In other words, until the end of the church age. Okay, well, all right. This is the first resurrection. So I guess that's when they get new bodies and now they're ruling and reigning something that isn't literal, but it's not the church age because the church age is over. Verse 6, blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they, i.e. the ones raised after the church age ends, will reign with him for 1,000 years. Oops. You see, this 1,000 years cannot refer to the church age, because the church age has ended, according to the preceding verses. So here we have a reference to 1,000 years that can't be the church age. So Klein's approach doesn't account for this one reference in verse 6, does it? And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison. That's verse 7. Well, which 1,000 years? The first 1,000 years, the church age, or the age that comes after the church age? So what I'm getting at is Klein's approach is devastating to traditional premillennial thinking, but it's not as clear as he'd like to think. Verse 6 muddies it, but the larger point is you don't need it anyway. The concept of a literal messianic reign on earth is built from a data pool that is much wider than Revelation 20, verse 6. So we're going to say a little bit more about this in the next episode. And the bigger question, I'm not going to get back into all the millennial stuff because we've done enough of that here. But here's the bigger question. What about Satan? What could it possibly mean to have Satan being bound during the church age, if that's what 1,000 years means? How is Satan bound during the present age? So that, quote, he might not deceive the nations, unquote. Looks to me like there's plenty of deception going on. Earlier in the book of Revelation, John has Satan alive and well persecuting believers, Revelation 2:10, Revelation 2:13, and trying to kill off the Messiah child. That's Revelation 12. The rest of the New Testament has a number of passages that presume Satan is active in tempting, persecution, in blinding the eyes of the unbelievers. So how are those ideas true in light of what Klein and others are saying about Revelation 20? And how could Revelation 20 be true in regard to Satan with all this other stuff in the New Testament? How can this make sense? How do we get a sensible portrayal of Satan out of Revelation 20 if we're supposed to be reading this? And again, I'm sold by Klein's presentation here, but he has to answer this question. He doesn't do it in the article. And frankly, the amillennialist answer to this is weak. I think there's a better answer to it. But if we're going to regard the 1,000 years here as the church age, Satan is limited in some respects so that he might not deceive the nations. We have to figure out what that means. Because whatever it means, it can't run and fly in the face of all this other stuff Satan is doing now in the present age. So how do we do that? That's going to be one of the places we camp, really the first thing we tackle in the next episode.
Well, Mike, Satan does it by, he's probably majority owner in the mass media companies is probably what he is. But no, that's a good
something
episode.
Like that. Yeah,
something like that. It's a good episode. I'm excited for the next episode, chapter 20. It's getting good, Mike. Yep. I wonder how it ends. Getting excited.
Go ahead and cheat. You look at the end, go ahead and cheat.
All right, I might read the last page of the book, see how it all ends. All right, Mike. Well, good stuff. Good deal. Don't forget, you can send me your questions at TreyStrickland@gmail.com. And with that, I want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.